Ladies and gentlemen, sorry for the delay, and welcome to the Solari Report. Today is November 1st, 2012. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Our upcoming events are very interesting. We have one more financial salon for changing times that I'm doing in Santa Cruz on November 14th. This is the fourth of a series that we're doing in the San Francisco Bay Area. And they've been absolutely fascinating, small groups of people, and wonderful, rich, very authentic, kind of real-deal conversations about both the risks and opportunities in the environment and what that means to your assets and investments. Then I leave for Holland next week. When I do the Precious Metals Report, I'll be talking to you from Holland, where I'm going to be speaking at an international conference on breakthrough energy technology. I think a lot about the impact of new technology on the current market assets, both risks and opportunities. So to me, that's an opportunity to hear from a lot of the scientists who think that energy technology is really ready to shift. And then finally, our next subscriber luncheon in Murfreesboro outside of Nashville on December 1st. I hope you can join us. The whole Solari team is going to be there. You'll meet all the producers for the Solari Report. We put up an ad and keep running an ad in the update calling for cartoonists. If you know a great cartoonist who'd like to work for us, we have lots of cartoons we want to make from the fiscal cliff. Just send an email to artist@solari.com. And again, every year we give donations to those people who've had the most positive impact on the world, particularly this year, again, focusing on people who protect us from dangerous food. If you want to have suggestions to give input before we make our decisions, just send your ideas to Kristen, K-R-I-S-T-N, at Solari.com. Tonight, Miracles Are Made, Living with Autism, an interview with Lynette Louise. It's a very uplifting interview, which is good because our news tonight is a bit gruesome, so hold on to the balance as I first dive into the gruesome part. My theme tonight is, once again, the boys stay ahead of the tipping point. Those who've known me for a long time know many other people predict terrible things in the economy. Oh, we're going to collapse. Oh, we're going to go. Another great question from a subscriber tonight. In fact, and on the webinar software, I hear many economists predicting a hyperinflation and an economic collapse, but from what I hear, you're predicting a slow burn as opposed to hyperinflation. Why aren't you concerned about hyperinflation and collapse of the dollar? Excellent question. We're going to be talking a little bit about that tonight because my theme tonight is, once again, the boys stay ahead of the tipping point. One of the reasons I'm such a believer in the slow burn is I've had more than several occasions to see how the system is managed. And oftentimes you'll see tension build up in the financial markets, in politics. And as that tension gets stronger and stronger, you think, well, things are really going to open up. We're going to see some real accountability. We're going to see some real transparency. And then all of a sudden something happens and the game shifts again. And it's like every time we're about to hit a tipping point, the people who manage the system shifted in a strong enough way so they stay in control. And I'll give you a perfect historical example of that. I was working with a wonderful investigative reporter at the time writing for Insight magazine, Kelly O'Meara, who'd done a series of stories about all the money, literally trillions of dollars missing from the U.S. Treasury between fiscal 1998 and 2002. And she was just about to publish a cover story that would be delivered to every congressman and senator's office on the so-called missing money. Big cover story with lots of graphs and charts showing how it impacted their constituencies, how much money per taxpayer in each state was missing as a result of the missing money. And then on September 10th, just as the story was about to hit congressional districts, Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of the Treasury, gave a press conference at Department of Defense confessing in front of the collected reporters that $2.3 trillion had gone missing the prior year from the Department of Defense. And I made the mistake of saying to Kelly, you know, nothing can stop this story from going mainstream now. Well, of course, we know what happened the next morning was 9/11, and Kelly's Insight magazine with a cover story finally hit hit congressional desks in the middle of September, but nobody cared. And sure enough, DOD got a big $48 billion increase in their appropriations. Well, I think we're looking at another event like that. The story of the week was clearly Hurricane Sandy, which has devastated New York, New Jersey, and areas of the Middle Atlantic East Coast. First and foremost, special prayers for all the people who have been impacted and are digging out from the storm. And let's all, in addition to giving and sending our prayers, pitch in to help people we know who've been impacted or lost power, lost property, lost their businesses. This can be a really a very traumatic and devastating thing to happen to many, many people. So I really do hope each one of us will do what we can do. But Hurricane Sandy was one such event. I think there's very little chance that Hurricane Sandy was entirely a natural event. The reality is that weather control does exist, and I believe that the U.S. Navy and the government have the power to, or the U.S. military have the power to steer and make such a storm worse. It's important to understand that as a financial matter, the markets were down for four straight days. Of course, they're usually closed on the weekend. And so they were down Monday and Tuesday. The last time the stock exchange was closed for two consecutive trading days was in the blizzard of 1988. This one didn't just close the stock exchanges, it closed the U.S. bond market, including the Treasury market, including stopping clearance and trading of U.S. dollar-denominated government securities in Tokyo, London, and around the world. So that makes Hurricane Sandy quite a major financial event. Why is it important? Emergency status that happens when you have this kind of hurricane can give the Treasury and government agencies the power to spend and buy in mortgage securities or assets. In essence, it opens the purse strings on a highly non-accountable basis, and a basis where the bill can just be put to the Congress. It doesn't really have to go through the normal appropriation and transparency process. So that's one thing. You're looking, in any emergency status, you're looking at an opening of the Treasury in a non-accountable way, or the potential thereof. The second thing is that closing the stock exchanges and the bond markets, including having four straight days with nobody around, gives you the ability to affect a whole series of literally hundreds of billions of transactions, and that could be used to do sort of an infinite number of things, but including covering naked shorts in the stock market, clearing maturing bonds, including fraudulent positions, which I suspect the Treasury market has more than its fair share of, and as well add resources to the Exchange Stabilization Fund. If you don't know what the Exchange Stabilization Fund is, you might want to educate yourself. It's a fund run for the Treasury, for the Secretary of the Treasury, by the New York Fed, but really by the New York Fed member banks as agent, and it's the mother of all slush funds with wide latitude to intervene in the markets. I've often believed when people talk about the big short positions, for example, on J.P. Morgan Chase, on silver, the big derivative positions that the Exchange Stabilization Fund is in fact backstopping on that, and J.P. Morgan Chase is acting as agent for the Exchange Stabilization Fund. It's also often referred to as the ESF. You'll see in my writings me talking about the ESF. So my guess is that this would give you the ability to implement or shore up or do a lot of things in the Exchange Stabilization Fund. Finally, it gives you the power to move physical gold or things that look like it both in and out of the vaults at the New York Fed and the COMEX. Don't underestimate the importance of Lower Manhattan as part of the depository entities. Now, there's no way to know what has really happened here, but my hunch is that whatever happened, it's going to be something that was very effective at shoring up the integrity of the Treasury and the New York Fed balance sheet. If I had to just guess, and again, this is an early hunch, the only way to tell about these things is hopefully you get bits and pieces over time that will inform the patterns. But my hunch is funds were moved out of the government and they were moved into the clearing systems. If anything, they could cover probably the most important, my guess is gold. If anything, my question is, was gold moved back in? There's hints and rumors of all sorts of different people sovereign nations who have their gold down in Lower Manhattan at the New York Fed wanting audits. So with gold moved in, certainly the exchange stabilization, my bet is would have been involved. This was an operation that would have had to have been approved at the highest level with a strong international consensus. It's interesting that it happened in October, which is the period of the greatest financial fighting and stress typically. That's a long-standing pattern. The Bohemian Grove was in late July. That would have given 2.5 months for the Navy to develop the plans and finalize and do this. So perfect timing. Figure that significant criminal liabilities were cleared, but not all of them. There's still plenty of basis for fighting going on. And I would say score a big success for the military-industrial complex, and the slow burn looks stronger than ever. And finally, never underestimate the power of the local share. It looks to me like a big chunk of change has gone to the governors to play along, and if there's problems with the economy, everybody can say, oh, well, it was the hurricane. The bottom line, whatever it was urgent. It was important. It needed to be invisible. But what we've probably seen is a clear demonstration of the power of the system to protect itself and to protect the balance sheet integrity of the U.S. Treasury and the New York Fed. One other thing to consider is that the Army is tired. We've seen a spreading of the U.S. military and U.S. bases, military bases all around the world. But as part of the fiscal cliff, if we're going to bring the Army back, or just, you know, a percentage of the Army back, it may be that we may need to bring more gold back to the USA, including possibly some that they took out on 9/11. So this was very big. Again, this is pure conjecture. It's impossible to tell what happened. Let's see what gets revealed. But one of the reasons I believe in the slow burn is I do not underestimate the power of the system to protect itself and do whatever it has to do to make sure that that slow burn keeps going. And the dollar is defended as the world reserve currency. After Hurricane Sandy, the most significant stories really come down to stories about leaders being killed. We talked several weeks ago about the Libyan ambassador, U.S. ambassador to Libya being killed. Now we have stories of a CNBC executive had two children killed in what was likely, I would say, was likely a professionally orchestrated hit. We have a British ExxonMobil executive gunned down in Brussels, his wife beaten. And then we have a Middle Eastern financial manager killed in the Alps. And you're literally watching more and more stories of very prominent people whose lives are taking on the risks of the South Central Los Angeles drug dealer. It reminds me of one of my favorite essays by Michael Venturi. He says, you know, we all live in the South Bronx now. To give you a sense of the stress, Vladimir Putin canceled a conference as a result of a backache. So it just goes to show you it's not necessarily so wonderful to be a leader right now. Disinformation was breaking out everywhere. I can't tell you how much time I spent this week deleting disinformation coming into me. When you have different events like this, suddenly the alternative press pours on the disinformation and often tries to attach it to real events in a way that we'll get a story going that's complete hogwash. But I've seen an extraordinary amount of hogwash, and that was part of the distractions, because if you looked at the news this week, it was all sports. I'm in San Francisco. The Giants winning the World Series is clearly important here. And it was all sports and Hurricane Sandy, and just as finally the World Series and Hurricane Sandy started to slow down, what did we see next? We see the former Penn State president charged with several counts in the child rape scandal at the university, including perjury, conspiracy, and endangering the welfare of children. And I can assure you that with it, it's literally every university administrator in the country is now completely terrorized, given the nature of pedophilia practices and just the risk of any kind of child abuse in any university as well. If you're a university administrator, you have a lot to be paranoid about. And when you add it all up, the message to leadership is that you and your loved ones are expendable, and so this is a dangerous world. And I think we're really seeing fear spread throughout the bureaucracies. The fiscal cliff continues to be something that's going to hit us really hard after the election, and the dead giveaway that the infrastructure is being put in place to affect tax increases and austerity measures in the United States can be seen from the drone stories. If you check out the blog, there's one after another stories of drones, even now a story of the U.S. Navy building drones for the sea. The ultimate worst was Homeland Security graduates, its first corps of Homeland Youth, FEMA Corps. So we're now going to have drones in the sky and sort of are the best and the brightest of young people running around the country as an army of snitches. It's very sort of disturbing, but those are signs that they're looking to put in tax increases. Let me just run through some of the other stories that are up on the blog that I think are very telling of some of the things going on. Disney buys Lucasfilm, George Lucas finally selling out for many billions. CalPERS sues Compton for pension and health contributions. We have a system of local municipalities and state government that have committed to major pension benefits and retirement benefits. And as the economy continues to slow down in lots of different sectors, we're seeing real tension between the pension funds and, are holding lots of mortgage bubble paper and the different municipalities who now have to make good on retirement contributions that they can't afford. So watch for more sort of breaking out of squabbling. And that's a real hint of things to come. In response to the question on hyperinflation, I have a new definition of hyperinflation. A Brazilian student has sold her virginity to a Japanese man for $780,000 online. If you don't believe it, check out the story. But that is truly a sign of some kind of inflation. Science and technology continues to dazzle. There's a great story on the blog about crowdsourcing a cure for brain cancer. A technologist who wasn't pleased with the attention he was getting from his doctor, so he got all his medical records, put him up on the internet, invited lots of people to come help him, which they did. Another cancer patient who grew a new ear from their own tissue. Also, I wanted to bring up, and you saw it on the blog several weeks ago, but lots of discussion in the investment community about a new material called graphene that's literally 200 times stronger than steel. It's made from graphite, from carbon, and materials can be made from it that can literally make anything from clothes to cars to cell phones. And imagine a car that's only a couple hundred pounds, and imagine it can go 200 miles per hour because it's so light. Anyway, it's an example of the tremendous potential for material science and what can be produced and sort of what that can do for the economy. A lot of creative destruction, but a lot of enormous opportunities. So check it out, graphene. To give you a sense of the dazzling speed at which technology is moving, I put up an announcement from Stanford Law School. They're having a seminar to describe how they got Nevada to pass the law allowing driverless cars. We now have three states that have passed laws saying cars that are self-driving can be on the highways. Google is the one who's been pushing it, both in California and Nevada. They're going to be presenting. And it's a perfect example that when the powers that be decide, some pretty radical changes in laws are going to occur before people really understand them or have built a consensus, you know, that it can happen. And to show you the danger of being a scientist these days, an Italian court sentenced six scientists and a government official to 6 years in prison on manslaughter charges for failing to predict a 2009 earthquake. So wrong place, wrong time. Lots of questions today. Let me go through them quickly. We have a great question about asking me about my lunch with Henry Kissinger, since that'll take 5 or 10 minutes. Kissinger's a sort of loquacious fellow. I will keep that question and answer it another time. Another one, mortgages will die with QE3, but who is the beneficiary? Is this simply a bank bailout, or are the banks under some obligation to forgive payments from the mortgagor? The big beneficiary of QE3 and the mortgage bailouts will be the black budget, who I believe the fraudulent mortgages were originally issued to benefit. Or my guess is that's, on a percentage basis, that's the primary beneficiary. But there's a long chain of criminal and financial liabilities in the chain of that issuance and the packaging and then servicing. So any financial institution holding or servicing or who packaged it and underwrote it to sell it to another financial institution who might be liable is now off the hook. So you have a whole chain of underwriters, servicers, and owning financial institutions. All of them get off the hook as to their liability or their financial liability, having paid, you know, $100 for something that, you know, is fraudulent. Anyway, so there's a whole chain, and my guess is one of the biggest two institutions to benefit are going to be Fannie and Freddie and, of course, the New York Fed member banks. Hi, Catherine. I left a post in your last Precious Metals report. The topic was on the housing market. During your report with Sanders, you had touched on it. Did you reply to these, and if so, where? I believe that question was answered in the Precious Metals Market report, but if you don't feel that it was, please go ahead and ask it again. Someone has asked a question about SmartAsset.com. Is this a company that would be useful for Solera users? SmartAsset.com is a company that's in the clouds, and it allows you, it helps you make decisions by a variety of different formulas. Should you buy a house? Should you rent? My feeling on all of these kinds of tools is that they're all always useful, but the formulas which can make you smarter should never control the decisions, because there are going to be too many things involved that are unique to you, and most really strategic decisions are informed by mathematics, but oftentimes can't be entirely solved by them. The other thing is never let them know it's you. You know, if you use these kinds of tools, do not let them know who you are and be able to connect that data through the cloud with other data about you. So you want to remain anonymous. And I said to somebody, they'll get me into the cloud when I go to the great beyond and not before. So just understand whatever you're putting into these tools is not private. So if you go into a pseudonym, that's fine. A great question from a wonderful subscriber. Let me read the whole thing. I see that you are consistently recommending documentaries as a way of spinning up on a subject. I find the document format to be entirely extremely unsatisfactory. It is a reasonably accessible way of finding out what a particular viewpoint is claiming, but it is of little or no use to me regarding whether those claims are supported by the complete set of evidence. And then he goes on to explain why. Do you share any sympathy with my viewpoint, and if so, in what ways do you find documentaries valuable? And what do you depend on to quickly sort the wheat from the chaff when examining extraordinary claims? This is a very good point, because documentaries are not academic treatises. And really, when you want to get a balanced view on the subject, oftentimes you have to get or try and find documentaries or books on both sides of an issue or in a variety of different ways. This is not just for and against. There's 360 degrees on issues, and it's also very easy to get a point of view without digging down and getting the kind of significant legal documentation that I put up to support my claims in Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits. So it's not a vehicle that really allows you to put forward an academic standard kind of support for a given position, or allows the reader to go in and authenticate all different sorts of claims. What it is very good is communicating quickly something that is a complex topic that otherwise many, many people couldn't take the time to understand without having that kind of mechanism. And the way I describe it, it's a little bit different between, you know, a picture of a bridge is one thing and the architectural specifications are another thing. And I find it very useful to have pictures on many, many different things. And then on occasion, I really do need architectural specifications. And so to me, documentaries are incredibly valuable. And I don't need to agree with everything in a documentary to find it valuable. So to me, it's not zero or one. It's a scale from 0 to 100%. And to me, a documentary that's useful is worth a lot. There were many documentaries I couldn't watch until I started to really develop the ability to read into it what was not included or what was missed or not understood by the person who made it or felt they couldn't put in it for a variety of reasons. So what do I depend on to quickly sort the wheat from the chaff? One of the things I depend on is experts in the field, so I'll often check with people that I trust in different areas and say, what do you think of that? What do you think of this? You know, et cetera, et cetera. The other thing is I depend on my own common sense, and I'm the first to say I don't know, but to use a documentary to fill in and say, well, you know, maybe it is this or maybe it is that. So I think I operate with a standard of usefulness, and I recommend that you do too, because we don't have the time to read the architectural specifications on anything. If we want to understand something at a very, very high level of integrity, you know, look at the picture first and then go diving if you want for architectural specifications. One of the most exciting things that's going on right now is development of multimedia in the world of publishing, not just documentaries, but of books. And I think the time is coming when it will be possible, whether it's a documentary or a book, for a book to have lots of video and sort of resource supports, again, of the kind I did at Dylan Reed, and a documentary as well. So the world is moving to the point where we can, you know, literally every documentary or book can come with a Wikipedia if we wanted to. Hello, recently discovered Solari, signed up for newsletter, studying how to find a local bank. Do you have a list of companies that contribute to economic and social injustice? If you're studying to find a local bank, I strongly recommend you take a look at our bank intimate section on the website. It's got a little piece called How to Find a Good Local Bank, and it'll just help walk you through the steps, and I think it will probably help you go through that search. In terms of companies that contribute to economic and social injustice, I think that most of us are pretty good using our own common sense of doing that. What I focus on is decentralization. I'm looking to avoid, the larger the company is, the more I am inclined to shun it, just because I think we need less centralization and more decentralization. It's pretty easy these days to understand the patterns of fraud and to check out the headlines on a given company. And if it's clear that they're involved in pattern of fraud or that they're deeply entwined with governments who are not aligned with your interests, to understand, it's probably better to stay away. My number one criteria is excellence in leadership, whether it's excellence in the governance, who's on the board of directors, who's in the management, who's involved with the company as auditors, as lawyers, as other sorts of critical strategic partners. And finally, recommendations and words of mouth is very, very important to me. So you'd be amazed if you keep checking and looking over time how easy it is for you to sort of figure out who's a reputable character and who's not. And this subscriber says, I'd like to start voting with my money and to spread the word. And I say, yahoo, keep going. Our hero tonight is Royal Raymond Rife, who was a scientist, arguably one of the greatest scientific geniuses of the 20th century. Rife is someone I've talked about many times. I was just speaking with a subscriber last week and discovered that they had never heard of Royal Rife, and I said, okay, I need to beat Royal Rife's drum a little bit more. One of the documentaries we've recommended in Let's Go to the Movies is The Forgotten Life of Royal Raymond Rife. It's up on the internet for free. You can find it with a search on the blog. We'll put the link in this blog post. But I cannot recommend it to you enough. It'll give you a very important insight into the history of science, the history of healthcare science, and why I say the suppression of healthcare technology is such an important factor in the problems we have in the United States with the cost of healthcare. Anyway, so Royal Raymond Rife is our hero this week, and I strongly recommend, if you know nothing about him, check out that documentary. Okay, so now turning to our interview tonight, we're going to be playing for you a recording of the interview. Lynette was flying to the Middle East this week, and so we were able to pre-record her at the beginning of the week. She is an expert in neurofeedback, particularly as applied to autistic children and the families of autistic children. She is a person who has a gift. You know, she's think of her as, if you know what a horse whisperer of, she's the equivalent of a horse whisperer for autistic children, is what one of my one of the subscribers who has availed themselves of her service said, when you listen to her, you will realize she has a remarkable gift to listen to children, to communicate her caring for children. She has a deep desire to help children and help people, and has done a remarkable job of doing that for many, many people. Autism is something that touches all of us one way or another. Recent estimates are that 1 in 80 children is impacted, a very unacceptable statistic. It's a condition that can have a very dramatic impact on the families that it touch, and as more and more children are impacted, so are all of us and our institution. Anyway, so without further ado, let's play our interview with Lynette Louise. Lynette, thank you very much for joining us on the Soleri Report. I appreciate your taking the time to do this. And before we dive in and start talking about neurofeedback and how it can help autistic children and other people, maybe if you could just very briefly go through an introduction to your works and your books. I'm sitting here looking at Miracles Are Made, A Real-Life Guide to Autism. So go ahead and just give us an overview of your work and your books.
Okay, sure. But first, let me thank you, because part of the answer to your question is the way that you help people with neurofeedback and the various therapies that I employ to reach families that deal with different brain disorders is through people like you sharing the audience that you've built up that respect you and your guests. And so I appreciate you for having me on, and thank you so much. It's lovely to be here. My work. I began as a parent, as is often the case with, I don't know about other fields, but certainly fields where there's any kind of mental challenge, even your counselor probably had something. So it tends to be collected around folks that have real life experience, and that's really true in the world of autism. Parents that have to help their children find there's a milieu of services now, and way back when I was doing it, there were none, and so you end up having to self-educate and learn how to cope and see what works and what doesn't work and what is the difference between coping and healing. And you go through so much that you become much more the expert very often, most of the time, than the experts themselves. And so they become your consultants and just sort of share their little piece of the world, whether it's your doctor or your neurofeedback person or whatever. So myself, I adopted 4 kids that were on the spectrum, and they were all in different places on the spectrum, so not only did I get that experience, but I got the experience of knowing that what worked for the goose didn't necessarily work for the gander. So,
now, let me just stop you for a second. Could you explain what you mean by the spectrum? Because not everybody knows.
I would love to, and always do that for me, please, because I'm used to speaking to parents who know what I mean. So, but understand, a spectrum is like it applies to everything, whether you're in the spectrum of humanity or the spectrum of autism or the spectrum of OCD or the spectrum of a cold. There's no such thing as we all get the same degree of it. So you can have a light cold, you can have a cold that kills you. You can have a light touch of autism that looks like a quirky, interesting personality that, you know, has areas of difficulty. Or you can be so impacted in the world of autism that you're an adult who hasn't been able to use the toilet, who's hitting himself and has no language and is drooling still. And so this enormous gap between the one in the top and the one in the bottom is a big problem in autism, mainly because it's misrepresented so badly by the media and shown as, you know, we show the savants, the media people show the savants because they're a much cooler story to show. But you don't, a savant is when you have a special skill. So everyone always says, when they meet someone and you say, oh, I have an autistic child, oh, what's his special skill? Well, we're working on wiping the bum. So, you know, we have to put this in perspective. It's one of my, you know, I stand on a soapbox going, that's not what it's like. This is hard for folks. So it's important to realize that there's this enormous spectrum. And I was blessed and challenged by the fact that I adopted someone on the bottom, someone on the top, and a couple sort of in the middle. So
right.
I began that way, and I learned a lot of things along the way. A lot of it didn't work. Most of it didn't work. As I passed through, I ended up discovering the things that did work for every single one of them, and now every family that I work with, and remarkably, every brain disorder I've ever gone to help somebody with has been positively impacted by this therapy. I've never come across anything that is so across the board. So, of course, I want to scream to the world, this is amazing, you know, check it out at the very least, and that's neurofeedback. So I wrote a book because how could you not? You know, I felt obligated. I felt like this is what I can share between case studies and life story. And now brain science, and, you know, I'm in the middle of my PhD in psychophysiology. I mean, I'm just so committed to try to get the credibility that makes my words listened to, because this is something that makes a difference every single time.
Well, you know, your book does, I thought, a very good job of giving you both the sense of all the different areas on the spectrum, but also how neurofeedback can attend. You know, it's not one thing, and neurofeedback is a process and a training that can help, you know, all along the way. So
yeah, and what's beautiful about it?
You got that sense.
Thank you. Good. And what's beautiful about neural feedback is it's not intrusive. Not that I'm against medicines, but things like medicine or even light and sound therapy, they're intrusive and entrain the brain. They force a sort of change. And I'm not comfortable with that as a person who's doing the work. I want something where I invite change, where I excite a person to change and grow and reach and stretch. And that's how I do all the play therapy and behavioral approaches. And, you know, I do advise a little bit on diet and supplements, but that's not where I'm educated. So I like anything that'll invite change and recognize that the brain is so much more complex than we can even begin to know. And we know so much more than we used to. And so we want to respect this organism, this beautiful, amazing organism, this associative network of, you know, 100 billion neurons, and say, okay, I bow down to you, you know more than I, but I can tell from out here that you're doing a couple things wrong, so let me give you that information. Well, that sounds impossible to do, and here comes neurofeedback, and it becomes possible. It's a way of giving information to the brain, in a sense, in its own language, because it's basically a binary code given in an auditory way, so it's a beep and a non-beep. And we, you know, we put it in a game format and stuff, but really, it's a code, almost like the machine language of the computer, you know, it's the brain language, saying yes or no. Don't fire that way or do fire that way. And simply by giving this almost a homing signal response in a beeping sound, you're able to encourage the person to try and make more beeps, which is they only get when their brain is shifted in a direction of balance. And when the brain shifts in a direction of balance, they see and they feel and they function better. And then the world operates by giving them great compliments and saying, wow, you're amazing. And now the world takes over and you take over. And your brain goes, well, why didn't you say that's what you wanted?
Now, so start out, just pretend that I know nothing about neurofeedback. Do I sit down at a computer? Do I sit down at what is it and how does it, take me through it as a complete beginner. If I were to do a neurofeedback session, what happens?
Okay, so now you've got the concept, so let's look at the actualities. I would invite you to sit down, and if you were an autistic sensory defensive person, I might have to really earn that trust. But at some point, whether it's because I put sensors on your head and let you throw them across the room, you'll trust me, always. So eventually, you'll sit or stand, hopefully nice and still, if I'm lucky. I'll clean your heads with a little cleaner to get all, you know, the dead skin or the hairspray product or whatever off. It's just wet with a little bit of sort of a granule feel to it. And clean that area, and then I'll stick some conductive paste in a sensor. You have to think of this as reading brains, not putting electricity in, because it looks intimidating, because then you're going to put a sensor on that is a wire. that's attached to an amp that then goes into a computer. So a lot of times people see this and they go, are they putting electricity in them? And no, it's the same as when your doctor puts the stethoscope on your heart and is listening to your heart. We're putting the sensor on the head and we're listening to the brainwave activity. Or like in an ultrasound when you pass the wand over and you're looking and seeing what's inside. So we're seeing what's inside. We're looking at the EEG. And on my computer screen, I'll see the EEG. I'll see, a graph that shows me that particular activity under that particular sensor. Let's just talk about one sensor. It'll get confusing. And when I see that, I can, from experience and learning, I can go, oh, wow, this particular spot, in comparison to what it probably should be, has too much really low frequency brainwave activity. I'm going to set it up so that it does not beep. The game will not work because there's a game computer too. So I'm going to set it up that it won't work as well whenever this person makes a lot of this activity. Then my computer is networked to another computer that the person's looking at. So they're sitting there with sensors on their head, and they're going into an amp, and they're looking at a screen that has a game on it, something really simple, like a Pac-Man eating dots in a maze.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
every time he eats the dot and a beep comes from that activity of eating the dot, the brain is told yes. Simply because you accomplished what you're after. That's how your brain learns. When you were a baby and you were reaching for the glass to pick up and you didn't make it, your brain went, nope, try again. Eventually you felt the glass in your hand and it said, yes, that's it. And that's how your brain learns. So this is just working with what's already happening. And every time it beeps and eats, your brain goes, yep, like that. And so it learns that why it was able to do that was it reduced this activity that was in excess. And slowly you shift that particular area into greater balance. And when that happens, neurochemicals change, the actual physiology underneath the sensor recreates itself, which it's doing all the time in response to the environment anyway.
And so walk us through a sort of the life cycle of your working with an autistic child. What happens? How long does it take? What's the progression when they start to use this technology?
Well, this is going to sound pretty miraculous, but I actually said it. Remember, I was a parent, and I know that what always was hardest was keeping a therapy going. It
mm-hmm.
drains you financially. It just drains you. So when I, driving, all of it. And so when I decided to really do this for people, I tried to create a business in a way where I made a living, I could support my family, but at the same time, I was enabling folks so that they could do the therapy themselves after I leave. And then I could go enable another group and another group and another group. So I'm always looking for clients in that sense because I do my job well enough to lose my job all the time, right? And work myself out of work. So I fly to someone's home. Sometimes I work with hospitals and schools and stuff, but predominantly I go into someone's home, and in 3 days of working with an autistic child, minimum, but I can do it in three. It's tough. I like five. In 3 days of working with an autistic child, I will walk in and I will convince them to do neurofeedback. They'll discover that the neurofeedback helps them feel better. If they're nonverbal, they'll at least have a few words by the time I leave. I'll have gotten the whole family doing neurofeedback at least one time, taught them how to do it, shown them the things that their child is already doing and how they've changed in even this 3 days, create kind of an approach, and leave. And they always look like deer in the headlights as I leave, like, are you serious? Did I just learn all that? And so then I support them for free for life over the internet via email. If they need more time from me and I have to come to them, then, of course, I charge. And if they need me to, schedule an actual appointment time, I charge. But I answer emails. I go through reports. I do 4 to 5 hours free a day.
Now, can do you, Do you find that families can learn enough from you in 3 to 5 days so that they really keep it going and get progress?
You know, some families I really have to keep guiding a lot for a while. All families, when I first left, email me a lot for the first bit and are a bit panicked because it's really fast. And I really am asking them to change everything, not just neurofeedback. Neurofeedback's amazing, but you can go to a clinic for neurofeedback. The reason this works so differently is partly because of this follow-up support, but it's also because, you know, technically you can get someone who's very capable to run the neurofeedback, or you can get someone who just knows how to push the buttons and stick their things on the head.
Right.
And both will work fine as long as there's someone overseeing the choices. So that's my job. I continue to oversee the choices. I just teach them really basic skills. And then I also teach them how to change the environment. Because thinking about this, the reason neurofeedback is so powerful is it's an environmental bit of information coming to the brain, and the brain just changes itself.
Right.
So if you can also change the environment in how the people are thinking and believing, then you're doubling the power of this, or tripling. So that's part of why it changes so quickly. That part's harder. Teaching them how to push the buttons on the neurofeedback and then answering questions, you know, one question every time they email me, and before you know it, a year's gone by and they're as good as many clinicians in the field. That's easier for me to do than recreate how they think about how their child thinks and change the dynamics in the home. That's a much bigger challenge, and it's doable, and we do it. But that's the tougher part, actually, ironically.
One of the things I found fascinating when I was reading Miracles Are Made is your recommendation that the whole family participate in it. In other words, everybody does the neurofeedback. It's almost like you're working with a whole electromagnetic spectrum of the whole family.
Well, I am. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, just think about one simple dynamic. Let's say you're a person that whenever you're really tired, you get a little bit depressed. And whenever you're a little depressed, your brain does what brains do. It scurries around looking for something to blame. Your child walks by and you think, oh, he doesn't talk and he's 8. And
right.
As that happens, you go, oh, just go to the other room. Give me a minute. I just want someone who can talk. You don't mean to
right.
do that. You don't mean to be cruel. You are a human being inside this dynamic, and you had a reaction to your own physiology. But what if you had a therapy in the house where whenever you started to feel yourself kind of slide down and lose your focus and intention and energy and joy, joie de vivre for life, you could sit down for half an hour and just stick something on your head, push the buttons Lynette said, relax back, and half an hour later you go, hey, baby, come here. Did you just say cookie? I think I heard cookie. I heard cook. You want a cookie?
Uh-huh.
It changes it that dramatically, and that's why this is huge.
Right, because at some point you really are dealing with a whole family system. It's
yeah.
really, yeah.
Yeah, you break all those loops.
Now, how have you found, I know you've worked with so many autistic children, including your own, have you found that this, in terms of coming back to a successful life and a productive life, you know, how much of a difference can this make and how long will it take? And I know
okay. I know that's everybody's
different.
Question. Yeah, it's everybody's
yeah.
question. But before I answer that, I just want to clarify that I don't just work with autism. I work with Parkinson's. I work with, you know, depression. I work with bipolar. And in most homes that I go into where there's an autistic kid, I work with anything there is. I have schizophrenia, all those things. And in most homes with autism, you have other disorders inside, which is another good reason for treating the whole family, by the way. So, you know, you might have a brother who doesn't have autism, but he's got ADHD, for example.
Right.
So those dynamics really fly and reinforce the disorders in the house. It's really nice if you can help everybody. And when you can help everybody, so that's why I wanted to start with that answer, piece of the answer. When you can help everyone, when everyone embraces doing this and says, yes, we are a whole family that wants healing, this goes quickly. And by quickly, we have to put it in perspective of where is the child on the spectrum and what is considered quick right now today. So I will give you some actual answers from actual cases. If I see a child and they're a baby and they've been, they're suspected of being on the spectrum, they're 18 months old, probably 3-4 sessions, and we'll change the story and you'll never have to get the diagnosis or know about it. Honest to God.
Wow.
Honest to God. If I see a child and they're 3 and they're severely impacted, and again, this depends on the severity of the impact. You know, maybe they're super, super inflamed and they have some encephalitis, or maybe there's so much to consider here. But I know you want an answer, so I'm going to give you what I can. So that was true. I've seen 3-year-olds that, you know, by the time they're 4, we're fine. We're talking, everything's fine, they're social. They're that cute, neat kid. And maybe when they're 6, they start to get a little challenged with focus at school, and they start to fall behind a little bit. So their family calls, and I say, well, pull out the neurofeedback. Let's do some more. And sometimes, you know, that's like an ADHD kind of thing, or they get a little OCD-ish, the stress of school, you know, maybe they get a little sensory again. But, you know, we turn it around again because the brain knows how, and we're catching it right away because the parents
right.
have a tool. If, let's say, I meet the child and they're 7 or 8 and they have no language. I'll use language because it's such a common thing for people to call out for, but we could just as easily be talking about sensory issues, potty training. I mean, there's a lot of aspects to autism, and it's unfortunate that in some ways that everyone thinks only language, because there's much, much more here. But we only have so much time, so language. Let's use. I'll just be like everyone else and talk about talking. And they're 8, and they don't talk. And I walk in. I'll usually hear some words and readdress how everyone's listening and responding, because most kids are talking. They're just talking very badly. They're not pronouncing well. They have lots of sounds they can't make, and they're not making eye contact in the appropriate way in order to let you know they're talking to you. They might talk and walk away. That might be their pattern. I want to answer them, but I can't do it unless I've got my back to them and I'm walking away and I mutter. So it's about educating people to know when the child is talking sometimes. Catch it and reshape it. I've never met a 100% nonverbal child. So that child is probably going to take, and let's say that family, let's make it the other situation where the family's not treating the whole family. They go, no, 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 I only want to treat my child no matter what I say. So they only treat the child. So the dynamics don't change much in the home, and so therefore the
right.
dynamics in their school situation don't change much. And they have a lot of direct trial stuff going. I would say that child's probably going to take 4 years to get non-generalized language. And then generalizing the language will take another couple. And as soon as you change that answer to the whole family's treating and I get to rearrange a bit how it's approached by their educators, then I could say that in 4 years we have generalized language.
Okay, so it's the big variables are how early you start, and then how much support there is in the environment to do this.
Right, and then something like there's a thing called state-dependent learning that is unfortunately not considered in by most of the therapies. State-dependent learning is when you learn something in a particular state, you have to be in that state to have good recall of that skill. So let's say you sit a child at a table in order to teach them how to speak. When they leave the table, they can't speak anymore. Not always,
okay.
but often. Yeah.
Right.
And so
right.
it's the same for us. Like if we study while we stay up late and drink lots of coffee, then without being overtired and caffeinated and walking around chatting, we may not be able to recall anything that we don't learn.
Right. Right.
Right. So the trick is to learn it in a way that you're going to want to use it. And if your audience takes only that bit of information, they'll change their lives.
Well, one of the things I wanted to ask you was about neurofeedback in addition to other children, to everybody, because it sounds to me like it's something that everyone pretty much can use.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons it's hard for me to get my voice out there as loud as I'd like it to be is because I say stuff like, I've never met someone with depression that isn't easy to help. And I've never met another neurofeedback therapist that doesn't agree with that statement. So that's an interesting thing. I mean, here you have a therapy that, you know, when we talk autism, everybody's going, oh, it's so hard. When you talk Parkinson's, oh, it's so hard. But when you talk depression, every single one of us therapists at a convention go, yeah, why can't we just, isn't that crazy? We can all just
right.
fix this. And
right.
yet it's a billion-dollar industry, so we're not allowed to say that, and maybe you'll get in trouble. You'll have to edit this out. Like, that's really the reality of it.
Really?
You know, yeah, that's the reality of it.
Yeah. Well, the reason one of the reasons I ask is I'm a great believer if I'm interested in something and trying it. So I tried neurofeedback when I first heard about it and had a completely unuseful experience. And so I've been reticent since then to try it again. And after reading your book, I said, okay, that's it. I've got to try this again. Because it seems to
I hope you didn't go to the same person.
No. They're across the country anyway. But it just seemed to me like something that would be worth trying. And I've had a number of subscribers over the last couple of years say to me that they've tried it and it's made a remarkable difference for someone in, you know, either themselves or someone in their family. So there's a lot of interest percolating around. I can just tell because if the Soleri Report subscribers are emailing me and saying, wow, you know, I did this thing with neurofeedback and it was incredible, you've got to have a show on neurofeedback. It's kind of percolating. It's as though
yeah, it really
it's
is.
Starting to yeah. So
can
here's the thing.
Can I address what you said? Can I address
Pardon
what
me?
You said?
Oh, yes,
you
please.
Might even be coming with a question, but just to know that neurofeedback is a term that actually encompasses a few things. So like neurotherapy itself, there's a bunch of different kinds, and some of them are piggybacking on the tried and true neurofeedback, and they're not even neurofeedback. So it's really important to know what you're getting.
Right.
I use the basic, you know, reward-based, looking, you know, talk to them. What are you getting? Are you doing ILF? Are you doing LENS? Are you doing Z-score training? Like, there's unfortunately, like with many things, it's gotten complex. And so the neurofeedback that I use is the one they began with. And it's I do SMR training. I mean, we could get complicated here. And I don't want to confuse people. So what I just want to say is make sure that you ask questions about what kind of neural feedback you're doing. And I answer every email that comes to me if they want to ask me.
Right. Okay. Well, and why don't you, I'll ask you at the end again, but why don't you just give your email out?
Sure. You know, you can go to my websites, and you can always email me through there, LynetteLouise.com or BrainBody.net.
Okay.
I have a personal email that I'll then respond from, but it's better to collect them through that source.
Absolutely. So one of the reasons I'm always concerned when you dip into an area like this is, of course, anything that you know, you let into your mind can also be, whether it's because it's unethical or it's not competent, it can also do a lot of damage. So I think that if you're as much a lay person as me, the question is, okay, well, this is a whole new topic. And I believe that it could be tremendously helpful, but I also believe if I get the wrong stuff, it could be unbelievably harmful or just another waste of my time. So if I just wanted to learn about neurofeedback, what it is, how it works, what to avoid, what to embrace, I can read your books. I can read your website. What else could I read? What else could I do to educate myself?
You know, first thing I want to address is that what would happen with neurofeedback, which is a lot different than, say, medicine or many other things, even supplements that you might use, is exactly what happened to you. So there isn't a big danger because
uh-huh.
what would happen is If the clinician's not very good, or you're doing one of these that isn't really as impactful as you need, or maybe you don't really need much and you're just kicking tires, and so balancing you is going to be so subtle that you don't notice anything, worst case scenario, you'll have an effect you don't like, maybe get hyper or get a little bit kind of la-la feeling, you know, almost like you did some pot or something because you have trouble focus and feel low or too tired feeling. You'll sleep it off and go back to normal. This is only going to impact you if you repeatedly do it. And if you don't like the effect, you won't repeatedly do it. So that's the beauty of it. It's safe. Yeah, and it's the same with the kids. When I go to work with an autistic kid, trust me, they don't do it if I'm not good at it.
Right.
But if I'm good at it, they'll sit with us, no matter how sensory defensive they are with wires and stuff, when they like how it makes them feel, they come to it, and that's one of the ways I know if I'm doing the right thing. So this is a very safe therapy, and that's one of its beauties. So please to understand that I want everyone to know. Just trust your gut. In fact, do that with everything. If you're not benefiting from the therapy, cut your losses and get out and just make it a waste of your time and that's all. You know, don't make it more. And then as far as people to read, I like Swingle's book. You know, but you can also, I think you do more good for yourself when you understand the brain almost than the neurofeedback itself, because that's your clinician's job. I would read things like The Brain That Changes Itself, things like that, and know the power of change and the power of possibility for your brain. And then when you walk up to a clinician and you're asking questions, they'll come from that knowledge place and a bit more information on neuroanatomy and what's possible. We are the most misled group of, I mean, humans are completely misled on how their brains work, and so they are easily led because of that. And that's where I would put my learning.
And the book you mentioned again, The Brain That Healed Itself?
Brain That Changes Itself.
The Brain That Changes Itself. Do you know who that's by?
You know, that I don't want to give you the wrong name. If I was in my bedroom looking at it, I could tell you. And if you want me to drop the phone and go see, I will.
We'll
and there's
find
also
it.
A man. Sorry, there's a man named Paul Swingle. I like his book too. It's quite readable. I believe his is called Biofeedback for the Brain.
Okay. Well, just take a moment and tell us a bit about some of the other kinds of imbalances that you work with in addition to autism. You mentioned ADHD. You know, just give us a sense of the different kinds of things you've had success with.
Okay, well, to understand that because I go into homes and treat whole families, I've dealt with everything. The most remarkable, you know, because every family has different dynamics and different disorders and a different cousin that had something happen. So, you know, it turns into usually a large group at some point. Not always, but often. So pretty much I've touched on most things that exist. Some things do seem to come up more often. So let's stick with those. I work with quite a bit of Parkinson's and have seen dramatic change working with Parkinson's, and that's exciting. I work with ADHD all the time. Things like RAD, there's reactive attachment disorder and all those things, I would just put them in the bunch of and say they all can be helped, like OCD, and when you're working with the little kids that have all these various labels based on behavior and anxiety and pushing things away, they're all very helpable because this therapy works so well for anxiety. So anything that's related to anxiety or depression, you know, bipolar, I have quite a few bipolar people that have really been benefited. So, I mean, I can keep listing, but what I would like to tell, to keep it more imaginable for your audience, I'll tell you a stroke story and an anorexic story.
Okay.
So, and they're the same family, that's what's neat. And actually, this family, I treated a Down syndrome boy, an anorexic daughter, a stroke husband, you know, a depressed wife. Well, it's kind of logical. You know what I mean? Like it was, you know, the whole family had different things, right? And they all benefited. But stroke can be amazing because stroke has this big healing anyways. And then it has what's called an S-curve. So you'll have a huge healing, then it sort of plateaus for a bit. Then you have another huge healing, and then it plateaus. And if I can come in after that second one, then we can make another enormous healing that can usually bring you all the way home. So it already has these two bumps in it, in its healing curve. And that's just the brain, you know, trying to regenerate itself and do its thing, and your family inviting you to try and all of that. And so I came in, and he already had his two healing bumps, and he was still doing a lot of crying, and that's common with stroke, especially in the location that he had it. Where you just cry and you cry. It's unremitting, and you just cry and you cry and you cry. And so the wife had heard about me and said, if you can just bring his confidence back, that's enough. And I said, well, let's do more than that, but okay. So I arrive, and I start, sure enough, I start trying to talk to him, but he's just bawling. So I said, well, I can't actually get any answers from you this way, so let me get you to where you're not crying. So I did 15 minutes. And this isn't unusual. So 15 minutes later, he's not crying, and I put it on pause. So it's 15 minutes of beeps feeding back to the brain that it's stuck in a loop. Don't function like this. And now we can have a conversation. He never returned to that.
Wow.
So now we're having and that's not where it ends. And now we're having a conversation and things, and this is documented by doctors and stuff too, this one. So, you know, we talk a little bit more. I've looked at a few records and stuff, and I say, okay, well, let's get your peripheral vision back. So peripheral vision is how far you can see to the side. And he'd lost it. So he could only see directly forward, and he had also a thing called left hemispheric neglect. So he ignored everything on the right. Not consciously, but his brain just unprocesses it. I've always wanted to work with that case. That, by the way, that was one of my curious things, so it's one of the reasons I took the case. So anyways,
right.
So I did another session, only this time I did a full session. So now we did the 30 minutes that's a normal full session, plus I finished the 15 minutes from the other. So 45 more minutes, and he has his peripheral vision back, and his left hemispheric neglect has stopped. In fact, he drove to the store and came back, and he was so excited he couldn't get over it. Now, there were many other things that we had to work on. He had to work on memory retention, and he couldn't do crossword puzzles anymore. And you know, now he functions better than pre-stroke, and this is a year and a half later. Those two examples are showing you how quickly the brain can help itself. It can get stuck. And if you can just sort of say, hey, you know, you're doing that wrong, it really does heal itself.
Well, let me ask you about two other fact patterns. Have you ever had the opportunity to see it applied to Alzheimer's?
Yes, although I have to admit I haven't had a lot of Alzheimer's clients, but I do have a friend who has done quite a bit, and then I've had a few clients of my own that have Alzheimer's. And yes, it's look, what I have to help you understand is that in our world, we've separated everything out into diagnosing it, trying to figure out what's causing it, and we need to do that to fully help. We do need to do that. But in that process, we've confused some of the issues. So neurofeedback will help your brain function the best it can.
Right.
So let's say you have ways of circumventing your problem, but you've gotten stuck and been reinforcing your problem instead of circumventing it. So the neurofeedback will help your brain find different pathways and solutions to the problem you have. So it isn't necessarily that you'll all of a sudden have enough dopamine with Parkinson's, or you'll stop having plaques and tangles with Alzheimer's, but you'll find ways around these issues. Now, this actually supports and makes sense with what we know about these disorders. Alzheimer's, it's known that if you, one of the ways to prevent getting it, if you're at risk, if that's your family history, is to constantly learn. To be highly educated and constantly changing what you learn, not just learn one thing all the time and get so good at that, but challenge yourself and constantly change what you're learning. And you'll probably not deal with this. And they've done autopsies where they look and they go, oh my gosh, why did this person not have Alzheimer's? They're full of plaques and tangles. And then they'll do an autopsy on someone else who had a terrible case of Alzheimer's, and they didn't have that much, but they were not circumventing their problem, not reinforcing the better ways to do or the alternative ways to do within the brain.
So let me ask you about one other fact, Saturn. Have you ever had a chance to work with vets coming home from battle who have battle fatigue or other syndromes from
the trauma? I just love that you're asking this question because my son, my son was autistic. He was high-functioning autistic. We did not let the diagnosis follow him. He got into the Army. Actually, he tried to get into every single branch of the Army and failed all the tests, but through test practice managed to get into the National Guard. He actually got a high score of that by then and got in as a helicopter mechanic, and he just worked his tush off to be good enough. And now he's good enough and capable and all of that, so he went to Kuwait. When he went to Kuwait, he came back. He came back with night terrors and screaming and PTSD. We fixed it. And because it's good pay, he decided to try it again. So he went to Iraq.
Oh, no.
Yes. And he's on, I just bought his ticket, actually, like an hour ago. And he's having a hard time. And he's on his way back. And I'll fix him. And I've been talking to his commander, and we're talking about taking that back and all of that. So in a very personal and very real sense, I'm invested in this, and the answer is yes. I've also done it for other families, but the creativity and the way that I can apply it to my own family, there's no boundaries on me. So I can do anything I think will help, and that's one of the reasons I've discovered many different approaches to the brain than maybe would have happened had I been just in a clinic. My family's been ripe with examples for me. So my little guinea pigs, I'm like, I think this will work. Come here, Dar.
Well, I love the different stories and miracles are made about all the different things you try and sort of the trial and error. You feel like you're in this giant prototyping process, but I can tell, you can always tell from reading your work or just from listening to you that you're somebody who listens at a very, very granular intent level. You hear people, and so I can see why you'd be very good at this. You can feel it.
Thank you.
So, well, this has been fascinating. We're running out of time, so let me quickly ask you two quick questions, and then I want you to revisit how everybody can access your work. We always, on the Salieri Report, we always use movies and documentaries to kind of inform a topic. And we had sent you the links for the two that we're using this week. I always do one, but this week I couldn't decide between the Horse Boy movie and then, of course, the movie on, I may mispronounce the name, Temple Grandin. Mm-hmm. Is that the right pronunciation?
Grandin. Temple Grandin, yeah.
Anyway, I wondered if you had seen either of them and if you had any comments on either one.
Yeah, I've seen all movies that have autistic people represented in them because I use movies to teach my son what the difference is between his autism and regular folk. So the Temple Grandin movie is very inspiring and, it's really, really, really well done. That's a movie, not a documentary, and it's well worth watching as long as people watch it knowing that she is not representative of the lower part of the spectrum. In fact, maybe watching both is a good idea because you get to see the challenge, because what is missing in the Temple Grandin movie is really what would have gone on for the mom, in the younger years. You see a little, but not really. In The Horse Boy, you're in the middle of it, and you see the desperation of the family just willing to try anything, and they don't cure their son, right? and they don't create, it sort of works and sort of doesn't, and they think it's a miracle when he can, use the river stream to go to the bathroom. So it gives you a sense of what it really is. I would, if they want to go searching, also see My Name is Khan. It's a wonderful movie about a high-functioning guy. It's very entertaining, and I just think it's gorgeous. But there's many, 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 by the way. But of those two, that's what I would say about them.
Okay. Okay, well, just take a moment and describe again your website, your books. I think you also have a radio show, too. Anything you can let us know, how we find your work, how we keep up on what you're doing, how we connect with you if we need to do that?
Okay. You can always connect with me. I answer every email I get, sometimes brief. My apologies. LynetteLouise.com is the more speaker-oriented educator, performer, because I was a performer as I raised my kids. I do a one-woman show about the brain, and it's very fun and silly, and I have a CD and all kinds of stuff. So you go there, you can shop, you can look, you can be entertained. Brainbody.net, there's a link on the LynetteLouise.com, but you also can just put in Brainbody.net. It's more orchestrated for the autism community and a few other disorders, and so that's a little bit less pizzazzy. I have several books, but the one that is about autism is Miracles Are Made, A Real Life Guide to Autism. You can get that at Amazon or all the usual places. You'll probably have to, if you go to a bookstore, tell them to get it. And you can also get it off my website. My other book was Before Neurofeedback, so if you want to believe I really used to be crazy and became sane, it's called Jeff, A Sexually Realized Spiritual Odyssey of Stepping into Love. So that one's a good read, have a glass of wine and be in private. But it's sort of in the middle of when I was trying to figure it out with the kids, too, and I was struggling as a woman, and I think it's worth thinking about, because people meet me now, and I'm well-spoken, and I know what I'm doing, and I know this disorder inside and out, and I really make a difference. But I wasn't here raising my kids. I was somewhere else learning it with them. And
right.
So it has a value. You know, it reminds you that you can do it, too, because you don't have to be at the end of the story till you're at the end of the story. My podcast is A New Spin on Autism Answers, and I try to make sure that we have a question that is answered every time with lots of entertainment and interest, and I tell stories all the time. So those are beautiful.
I'm trying to remember, was it your website or book? It was somewhere, I think it was you that said, you know, if you're not happy, then it's not the ending.
There you go. I don't know if I said it, but I probably did. It sounds like me. And I approve. I do want to just quickly tell you I'm in the middle of making something called Fix It in 5. In fact, I just shot a piece of it. It's amazing. It's going to change everything, and I'm about to be on the Autism Channel. That's a new internet channel. But Fix It in 5 is my baby that I'm going to go bankrupt doing if someone doesn't come out of the woodwork for me. And it's 5 families internationally. I go in with cameras. I've already done the first 2. One was in Uganda. One was in San Francisco. We had a violent boy. He knocked out my tooth. Now he's calm and came on stage Sunday. It was beautiful. We had, in Uganda, a girl with seizures and no seizures now and talking now. And I want to do 3 more countries, very different situations, to prove that this goes across the board, across cultures, that this is something, the way I approach it, really makes as big a difference as I say it does. I want to, put my money where my mouth is, literally, and show the world this, and I hope I get to the end of it. So there is a campaign about it on Indiegogo. We're done at the fundraising part, but they'll let you get money anyway. You can always.
Okay, and how do I? Can I find it from your website? How do I?
You can go through my website, or you could even just Google Lynette Louise Fix It in 5, or you can go to Indiegogo and put my name, put Fix It in 5. I try to really be easy to find.
Okay, we'll put a link up to it on the blog post for the.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Clear report this week. Okay, well, Lynette Louise, our time is up. I can't thank you enough for joining us on the Soleri Report. Just, you're doing marvelous things. I know that from my own personal network, and our prayers are with you as you go forth, continuing to heal and help and make the world a joyous place. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me, and goodbye, and thank you to your audience.
Okay, so we're just going to give 30 seconds for the recording to end. Okay, I just wanted to say a few additional words about the 2 movies. And I always do one movie or documentary, and I literally couldn't decide between these 2. as Lynette said, Temple Grandin is a movie, so it's a fictionalized movie based on a true story. And it's quite remarkable that a wonderful subscriber tried to persuade me to watch this movie, and for a year I thought, oh, I should watch it, but, you know, it's going to be depressing. It's not. It's one of the most inspirational stories I've ever seen. It's about, as Lynette said, she's not a very autistic, but someone who's on the lighter side of the spectrum, who has autism, who becomes a very successful designer of facilities for, it's really animal science. And it's a remarkable example about how a very intuitive intelligence can come into an industry and revolutionize it with things which, when you look back on it, seem totally obvious, but of course nobody was bothering to listen and put themselves in the, you know, think of it in the from the point of view of the animals. But it's really, it's a remarkable story about what one person can do and the difference that one person can make, particularly if they think differently than everybody else and are very, very persistent. It's also, a subplot is how remarkable a loving mother can be and what a difference she can make. The other is a documentary called The Horse Boy about a child who's severely autistic and the parents trying every possible therapy. Again, as Lynette described, ultimately take their son, I believe it's Outer Mongolia, but over to Asia, to a healer who has a way of naturally manipulating the boy's electromagnetic field and get some improvement. And it's an interesting story, and it takes you into a family to see what a severe autism can do to an entire family and their entire life, how it can turn everything upside down. So it's a fascinating story. The people who made it, the son is autistic, it was the parents who made it, when they came back, they run a farm where children, autistic children, disabled children learn to ride. So both of them are remarkable stories. Lynette also mentioned another one she had recommended that I haven't seen, but the link to that is up in the subscriber links on the blog post and the other book, the links to other books and other things she mentioned during the interview. So we hope that that was helpful. Coming up, next week is Precious Metals Market Report. I'll be talking to you from Holland, where I'll be at the Breakthrough Energy Conference and hope to have the opportunity the following week to report on that when I'll be back in the States in San Francisco. And we'll be rejoined by someone, a very special person who's been on the Solaria Report once before, Catherine Albrecht, an expert in privacy. The interview is called A Passion for Privacy. Catherine is the author of Spy Chips and has done remarkable work helping people understand the implications of how intrusive technology can be. And then we're off for the following Thursday is Thanksgiving, so we will not be having a Solaria Report, but we'll be back on November 29th when John Rappaport and I kick off our new series on real solutions, and we're calling it And the Solutions Are. So until November 8th with the Precious Metals Market Report, I'll be talking to you next week. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.